I have the job. Actually, it's a tremendous privilege to introduce the book of Job because over the years, Job has become one of my best friends. So it's always great to be able to introduce one of one's best friends. You might say, well, what's Job like? Actually, I think of Job every time I go along the Newcastle Freeway these days. As you may remember, we live in Newcastle. As you may remember, the Newcastle Freeway was cut by bushfires for several days. And one of those days, my friend and colleague Ruth Myers and I had the task of getting to Melbourne, where we were expected to speak at an orientation course. And the only way that we could manage to do it was to go via Merriwar, Gulgong, Cowrayung, etc. And we met quite a number of interesting travellers on the way, going from all kinds of interesting places to all kinds of interesting places. The service station did a very good job, did a very good trade during those days. But when we came back from Melbourne just a week later, the freeway was open. And as we drove through, we were absolutely shocked at what we saw, the total devastation of so many of those trees, so much of that bush just totally black. And I often drive up and down that freeway, and lately, as I've been driving along it, what do I see but amazing little kind of green ruffs coming up all over the trees, not just where you expect leaves to be, but right from the bottom all the way up. And it's terrific. Every time I go through, there's a bit more green. And I think to myself, well, that's really a picture of the book of Job in a way, beginning with total devastation, and yet, as Jesus said, when Mary and Martha sent the message to him that Lazarus was sick, he said, death is not to be the end of this matter. The end of this matter is to be the glory of God. And every time I pass those trees now, I think of that. The end of this matter is new life to the glory of God. And that's what the book of Job is all about. I use this Tyndale commentary by Francis Anderson to help me understand Job because parts of it take a little bit of understanding. And I find this very useful. It's probably in the bookshop if anyone wants to buy it, just to throw a bit of light on some of the more difficult passages. But one of the things that Anderson says is that Job is one of the best gifts of God to man. Job is one of the best gifts of God to man. And just imagine it. You and I have the whole weekend to study one of the best gifts of God to man. And I agree with that. Soon after, I was a missionary in Papua New Guinea for 17 years, and soon after I arrived, one of the senior missionaries said to a little group of us, why did God bring you to Papua New Guinea? And we thought we knew the answer to that, but we didn't. The answer was, in order to do you good. And I thought, well, what kind of a reason is that? I'd far rather be done good to in Australia than in Papua New Guinea. But as the years went by, I began to understand more and more what he was actually saying, that we can only pass on to others in authentic ministry what we have genuinely received from the Lord. And it was turning out that it was in the hard situations, in the painful situations, that we were receptive to what the Lord had to say to us. And so I worked out this little thing, that what that missionary was actually saying to me was, pain leads to growth, and out of that comes ministry. And Job and Paul were two of the friends who really helped open my understanding to what the Lord was saying there. I often used to say to myself in Papua New Guinea, what you need is a good dose of perspective restorer. Because when the hard things happen, the painful things happen, our world tends to get smaller and smaller, does it not? And we're so taken up with the pain that we're experiencing that we're not aware of what's going on outside. And as I read the book of Job, I see him with such a wonderfully expanding mind, and constantly talking to his friends about the marvels of God in creation, the wisdom of God, the understanding, his counsel and so on, while in the midst of his pain. And to me, his attitude, his responses have been over the years a wonderful perspective restorer. So, if you're looking for an up-to-date book on grief and loss, you can't do better than the book of Job. You really can't. It's absolutely incredible. And if you're looking for advice about how to be there or how not to be there for grieving friends, you can't do better than the book of Job. And if you're wanting reassurance that hard things are not meaningless, that the hard things that we go through are not meaningless, Job's your book. And if any of you are in any kind of deep pain right now, this book will give you genuine hope as you study it and ask the Lord to reveal what he's saying to you in it. Well, it's 42 chapters long, and Ruth and I feel that we really can't go through it verse by verse, okay? Although we'd love to, we really would. I'd love to have enough time to go through it verse by verse. But we can't, so you'll have to do that. But I want to just, in this little introduction, talk about some of the themes. The first one is the model that Job gives to us. It's a picture of one man in overwhelming loss, hanging on to his faith in God, and in the end coming out into things far too wonderful for him to even begin to describe. Let's look at chapter 42. We don't want that gem to be messed up by my faulty memory of it. Verse 3, Job reflecting on God's revealing himself to him and his whole situation. The second part of verse 3, chapter 42, verse 3. Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. And in one of the paraphrases, it goes, I was talking of things I knew nothing about, things far too wonderful for me. And it's good to remember that when Job said this, he was still in the middle of his pain. And yet the revelation of God to him was such that he said, I was talking of things far too wonderful for me. So I've just worked out a little thing with four words beginning with T that might help you to remember this key theme. And it goes, trouble leads to tunnel, leads to trust, leads to treasure. Trouble, tunnel, trust, treasure. Sometimes when people think of the book of Job, they just think about the trouble and the tunnel, and they don't think about the trust and the treasure. But remember that little green collar on all those black trees. That's the treasure that's coming out of all that blackness. Trouble. One of Job's friends said in chapter 5, verse 7, man is born to trouble, as surely as sparks fly upwards. Stand up, the person here who disagrees with that. Okay, we all agree that that is so. And Jesus, in John chapter 16, verse 33, just before he left his disciples, said, in this world you will have trouble. In this world you will have trouble. And I find it absolutely fascinating that the word translated trouble there is the same word as he used earlier of the pain of labour. Now, what's fascinating about that? Well, the fascinating thing about that is, and I'm speaking with my obstetrician's hat on, and my experience of about 3,000 confinements. I admit I've never had one, but I have been at 3,000 confinements, so I know a little bit about it. And I know that whatever you say about the pain of labour, you can't say it's meaningless. I mean, it's accomplishing something, isn't it? And in the end, you've got something to show for it. Something amazing, something magnificent. So therefore, I find it really interesting and encouraging to find that Jesus is really saying, in this world you're going to have pain. It's like labour pain. It's not meaningless pain. Okay? You're going to have trouble, but it's not meaningless pain. So going back, I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. So T is for trouble. Man is born to trouble as surely as the sparks fly upwards. And trouble, if it's bad enough, tends to put us into dark tunnels, does it not? It certainly did Job. Dark tunnels of grief and pain in which we cry out, why, Lord, why is this happening to me? And we struggle to find God and to understand what is happening, what he's saying to us, to understand more of his ways. We'll come back to that in much more detail tomorrow and on Sunday. And then the next T that we learn from Job is trust. And we must have a look at 23 verses 9 and 10. If I don't put a book before it, you'll know that I'm talking about Job, our friend Job. 23 verses 9 and 10. This is talking about trust. I'm reading 9 because I find it so fascinating that Job is setting the scene. He's saying, I don't know where God is. I wish I did, if only I knew where he was. He's saying, when he is at work in the north, I do not see him. When he turns to the south, I catch no glimpse of him. But he knows the way I take. He knows the way I take. Now, you and I have a huge advantage over Job because we know what had taken place between God and Satan. And we know that Job was absolutely right to trust God. But Job didn't know that. Never let us forget that. Job didn't know that. Neither do you and I know that when we're in the middle of our pain. But the challenge to us is to take the message of this book and say, yes, Job didn't know, he didn't understand what God was doing, but he trusted him. You and I know that God was in control, that there was a purpose in Job's life that God was working out. And can you and I somehow transfer that to our situations and say, yes, I remember what happened in the case of Job. I believe that that's what's happening in my case. So therefore, instead of staying in deep despair, can I go from trouble into dark tunnel to trust? Okay. And the outcome is treasure. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. Death is not to be the end of this matter. The end of this matter is to be the glory of God. And the treasure, of course, for Job was a personal encounter with God, which caused him to say, I was talking of things I knew nothing about, things far too dreadful for me, things far too wonderful for me. That was the treasure. That's the first theme. The second theme that I want to mention, hands up those who are asleep. Okay, no hands up so we can continue. This is a very important one, but it's a little bit mind-stretching. So let's just wake up and listen. The second theme I want to mention is folly as against wisdom. Folly as against wisdom. In the book of Job, folly equals ignorance of God. Job chapter 42, verse 7. After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz, or Eliphaz, depending on your school of thought, the Temanite, one of Job's friends, "I'm angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." And then further down, "My servant Job will pray for you and I'll accept his prayer and not deal with you according to your folly. You have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." And then Job prayed for them and things were all okay. What God had against the friends was that they had spoken according to folly. And what did they do? What did Job's friends do in response to Job's pain? They kept God in a box. They thought they knew God. They thought they knew what God would do. And they kept Job in a box. "You must be a sinner. If you're not a sinner, all my beliefs about God are going to fall in a heap. So you've got to be a sinner. Because God punishes sin, therefore you've got to be a sinner." That was their folly, their continued ignorance of God. And as opposed to that, Job's view of God was the one of exploring into God. He knew that he was innocent. He knew that God was good. He couldn't line the two things up, therefore he was prodded to explore into God. And that was wisdom, longing to understand more of God. Chapter 28, verse 12, "But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell?" And I see you've given up, and I don't blame you, because I'm whizzing around all over the place. But at the end of this chapter where Job talks about wisdom, we come back to this familiar thing, the fear of the Lord. That is wisdom. And to shun evil is understanding. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and keeping on exploring into God is a continuation of wisdom. And seeing him face to face, on that day when we see him face to face and we will be like him, that will be the fruition, the culmination of wisdom. Are you with me? Okay. We're going to elaborate on these things later. But, you know, it's like Paul in Philippians 3 saying, "I know him, I want to know him." Job's friend said, "We know him, full stop." Job didn't say that, Paul didn't say that, and you and I, hopefully, won't say that, because if we do, we're going to stop growing, and God will say, "That is folly. I want you to grow in knowledge and in understanding of me." That's what wisdom is all about. Even when God questioned Job, revealed himself to Job, it's interesting that in chapter 38, verse 2, he began his comments by saying, "Who is this who darkens my counsel with words without knowledge?" See, Job was pursuing wisdom, but he hadn't arrived any more than Paul had. He was still obscuring the counsel of God in his ignorance. Okay, so I better hurry along, hadn't I? Yes, Viv said yes, okay. Okay, the other themes, I'll mention them quickly, the effects of grief on relationships, and I'm going to talk a lot more about that tomorrow, if spared. Fourthly... the unchanging goodness of God. He transforms our pain into joy. And this is one of the great mysteries. It's not that he gives us joy in exchange for our pain, but somehow or other the joy is made out of our pain. Okay. And fifthly, he appoints us beyond the Old Testament, this book does, to the Mediator, the Redeemer, personal resurrection, to Jesus, in which hope finds fulfilment. And I'm sure that Ruth's going to talk about that, so I won't say any more about that. Okay, so we're coming back to setting the scene. Chapter 1, verse 1. Who was Job? In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job, as the commentators tell me, was probably a place to the east of the Jordan Rift Valley, on the periphery of Israel. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. Feared God and shunned evil. Are those words familiar? What was the link that we mentioned just a moment ago? Feared God and shunned evil. Beg pardon? Wisdom. Somebody said wisdom. Yes. Okay. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And turning away from evil, that's the beginning of understanding, or is to that effect. Okay, so two key things are brought out in this first verse, which is absolutely vital to our understanding of the book. One, that Job was blameless and upright. He wasn't perfect, he was practically perfect. We know that no human being is perfect. I heard about a preacher who asked the audience, "Have you ever heard of a perfect person?" And a woman stood up and she said, "Yes, my husband's first wife." But given those kinds of people aside, Job was practically perfect. He wasn't perfect, but he was practically perfect. He was blameless and upright. And if you want to, we haven't got time now, but if you want to, if you can't sleep tonight, have a look at chapter 31 and just run through all the things that Job wasn't guilty of. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I'll do it quickly. Lust. He wasn't guilty of lust, lying or deceit, adultery, injustice to his servants, failure to help the poor, widows or orphans. He didn't fail in trusting in his wealth. He wasn't glad about others' misfortunes. He didn't deny hospitality to strangers. He was never hypocritical. He never mishandled land or tenants. Those were just some of the things that he didn't do. And I'm sure there are plenty of other things that he didn't do. So he was practically perfect. The fact of his integrity and of his devotion to God are central to this book. And he says in about chapter 29, God's intimate friendship blessed our house. So God and Job had this deep, intimate relationship, and that's absolutely vital to the book because God allowed all these terrible things to happen to the one whom he loved and who loved and served him. And what does that remind us of? Nothing? Okay, we'll press it. chapter 29, around about verse 18, I think. No, 4. Yeah. Oh, for the days when I was in my prime, when God's intimate friendship blessed my house. Okay. Now, I was just thinking that it reminds us of the Lord Jesus, does it not? The way God treated his own son. And so that's another thing that we need to take on board about Job, that he becomes a type of Christ. He was a man of integrity and a man of devotion to the Lord. This inconsistency between what God did to this person whom he dearly loved, of whom he said there's no one like him in all the world, and people's idea of what God was like was really what the friends couldn't handle, but we come back to that later. Verses 2 and 3, we see that he was also a very prosperous person. He had 10 children. He had huge number of sheep and camels and oxen and donkeys and servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. Okay. Now, verses 10 to 20, what happened? Well, suddenly a series of devastating losses. First of all, of servants and livestock. 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels and 500 donkeys all destroyed, and all his servants, we don't know how many, a great number. And it's interesting that the first attack was by another group of humans, the Sabaeans. The next one was by the fire of God. And the next one by the Chaldeans. Then all his children were killed in a hurricane. Then later on in chapter 2, we see that his health was very badly eroded. He had painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. And then he lost, but these are the losses. the support of his wife, the support of his friends, the respect of his community. Read chapters 29 and 30 for that. So, I don't know about you, but I have never met anybody who has lost a fraction of what Job lost. Okay? So none of us can say, well, Job doesn't understand my situation because he never went through what I went through. Okay? And to all this, Job responded in an incredible way. He didn't charge God with wrongdoing, and he didn't sin in what he said. And I know Ruth's going to deal with those tomorrow, so we won't take any more time thinking about them now. But I do want to just finally have a look at what lay behind all this, because as far as you and I are concerned, this is absolutely crucial if we're to emulate Job's trust in the Lord. And we're talking about verses 6 to 11 in chapter 1 and verses 1 to 8 in chapter 2. Verse 6, chapter 1. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered, "From roaming through the earth and going to and fro in it." The picture is of a very restless, ceaseless activity to undermine you and me. On my way down here, I gave myself a nasty hit on the head, not once, but twice, and I began to wonder what was going on. I don't know, I just mentioned that. Once when I was putting petrol into my car, and cracked my head on something. And then when I was getting my luggage out of the car, cracked my head on the door and nearly saw stars. I'm not sure what's happening. And here I am sniffling and scarcely able to speak. Okay, but mercifully I can say a few words, as you've noticed. Satan's ceaseless activity to undermine us. And God says, "Have you noticed Job? Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." And Satan says, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has, etc., etc.?" To paraphrase that, no wonder he serves you. You've blessed him in every conceivable way. Oh, he's obviously just in it for what he can get out of it. That's clear as day. And if you take away everything that he has, he'll soon curse you. Okay? God says, "I see him differently, so I give you permission to take away all that he has, and we'll see what happens." So we see that God is trusting Job to do the right thing. Isn't that absolutely incredible? And if we carry that over to you and me, I wonder if God's trusting you and me to do the right thing in our hard situations. I wonder if God's honour is at stake in my responses. That seems to be the message that's coming over. So we know what happened, that Satan did his worst, and Job did not curse God. He did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. So in verses 1 to 8, the same scene is repeated. In verse 3, the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." And this is often our cry. Why is this happening to this person? He's lived a good life. People say this over and over again. Why is it happening to us? Okay. And Satan says, "Okay, well, you can take everything you like away from people and they might be able to cope with that. But touch them on their bodies and it'll be a different story." So the Lord says, "All right, do your worst, but spare his life. You're not to kill him." And so we know what happened to Job, and we know that he still didn't sin in what he said. But the whole point about this passage is so that you and I will know that behind all the dreadful things that overtook Job was a loving God, a God who loved Job so much that he was willing to stake his honour on Job's response. He believed that Job would not curse him, and he didn't. And so, to me, this is a huge challenge. To even begin to grasp the idea that in the hard things that happen to me, not only is there opportunity to trust God in this, believing that I'm going to come through to that treasure, but there's also the challenge to be trusted with the unexplained, because in some mysterious way that I can't understand, God's honour is at stake. And to me, that's one of the deepest challenges of this book. We know that pain changes people. We know that when people are in their dark tunnels, we don't philosophise about treasures and things. But just as with the woman in labour, now somewhere deep down in the midst of your pain, you can say to yourself, well, the time's going to come when I have my baby and I see my baby's face, and there's going to be joy, and I'm going to be able to look back and say, well, it was worth it all. Just as I can say that to myself when I'm in labour, I think. So when I'm in the world and I'm in the middle of tribulation, which, as we've already heard, is like labour pain, not meaningless, I can say to myself, I'm going to see God face to face. I'm going to one day understand what this was all about, but it may not be in this world, but the whole point is that this world is not all there is. And we come back to Jesus' words to the disciples, in me you may have peace, in this world you will have tribulation, in me you may have peace. And I think this is Job's message to us. Let's look in closing to chapter 23, verse 12. Job says, I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my daily bread. Because Job was the one who treasured the words of God's mouth more than his daily bread, when the hard things happened, he responded by being open to what God had to show him in it. And most of the book of Job is the story of Job's hard struggle to explore into God, and in the end, coming through to the treasure of coming to know God in a way that he'd never known him before, and out of that flowed ministry. So trouble, tunnel, trust, treasure is the challenge to us. And I'd like you, before you go to sleep tonight, to read chapters 1 and 2 and ponder them, and also chapters 29 and 30, because they're quite illuminating in terms of what's going to follow. Death is not to be the end of any story for the Christian. The end of the story is to be the glory of God. Amen.